Welcome to Paper Money, the podcast covering the business side of the game industry. I'm Ben Clark.
And I'm Rhett Kipp.
Today is June 15th, 2012. Yeah, that would be the sucking sound of the days going by as the number of days were late getting the show out. Apologize about that, folks. Memorial Day, which is normally when we would have targeted the show, or actually the week after Memorial Day, was also the week of Origins. And was anyone here at Origins?
Yes, there were a lot of people at Origins.
Exactly. So there were some people kept busy that week. So and then I got busy last week. So again, apologize about the late show, but we're going to make up for it with our usual fine quality.
That's right.
Or maybe we should make up for it with extra quality over what we normally do.
Oh, well, that could happen too.
It could, but it won't. that said, let's jump right into the news. Origins was the first week of June, and their website has not been updated since April 17th.
Well, you know, that makes sense. It's been there's nothing important like how many attendees were there and that they had a good time and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
They didn't even – I don't even know that they listed the award winners on the site.
Why would you do that?
I found them on the Purple Pawn and some other news sites, but I didn't find them at Origins.
You know, it was an interesting it's an interesting thing. I have some background to that, but I won't explain it on this show because we're trying to keep this relatively quiet.
Yeah, again, I won't, like I said, I don't mean to diss Origins because, and you have told me, and you will now tell the audience, that it seems to have been a really good show.
Yeah, actually, it had some interesting things. The early part of the show, Thursday, Friday, seemed really slow. And having talked to a number of the exhibitors there and things like that, people were saying that, you know, they were really behind. There were some people that were quoting me that they were down as much as like 30% over the previous year, 60% over the previous year. However, really big crowds came in on Saturday. I mean, really big crowds. And their new, you know, badge thing of, you know, the free thing where you can walk around and buy stuff, so on and so forth, really seemed to have done well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people with those, it's like a bracelet that they wear so you can identify them. Anyway, a lot of those people were there. There was much larger attendance on Saturday than seemed to be prior to Saturday, certainly in the exhibitors area. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were claiming that their numbers were up. I actually had a couple of guys who said they were on a pace that by Saturday night, they anticipated having record sales, and they had been down 30% on Thursday night. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a huge.
So they made it all up on the weekend.
So it seems like they made it up on the weekend. I do know that there were some major successes. You know, there's a lot of people who don't attend. There's a lot of major players like Fantasy Flight who aren't there. There are, I think Wizards didn't. I'm not sure if Wizards had a booth or not. If they did, it was very small. But they definitely had a presence there. Fantasy Flight has a presence there in games. But again, they're not there as an exhibitor. A lot of smaller companies came to Origins who hadn't been there in a long time and didn't seem that pleased about having been there. I won't name names, but some people that hadn't been there for quite a few years came back and decided that they probably would not return. The people at the front end of the hall, which would have been Mayfair, who was enormous. Mayfair's footprint at Origins is nearly the same as it is at Gen Con. And Catalyst Games, both seem to do really, really well. I know that Catalyst launched Leviathans, sold out in under an hour.
Did you get me a copy?
No, you didn't get a copy.
Oh, come
on. Oh, God, you're going to have to wait like everyone else until Gen Con.
I am going to put a bullet in your brain if I do not get one at Gen Con.
Well,
that will be the end of our friendship.
You'll have better odds of getting one at Gen Con. And it actually is going to be in retail before Gen Con, which is also very nice. So the retailers will have it. It'll be gone. And then there'll be a few copies at Gen Con that'll be available for sale. The surprising one was Balance of Power. Balance of Power, there was some early release again from Catalyst on that one. That's a game that another one they'd been announcing for a while.
I'm trying not to be a fanboy. I played that one at Gen Con the other year, and that was what I was just about to go, ooh, I really want that one too. But yeah,
well,
that's
The one that struck me as
journalistic objectivity on my part.
Yeah, the one that struck me as most entertaining on that one was not only did it sell out, They even sold the demo copy. There was so much demand, they actually packed up the demo copy and sold it to a guy.
Well, Balance of Power, it was a really great Euro style design. It wasn't, you know, I mean, if you play BattleTech or you've gone to one of the Leviathan's demos, they're a little tech heavy, right? They're a little rule heavy, and they play, they're great games, but that's the way they work. Balance of Power, I could explain to someone in 10 minutes or less and
Five
have
minutes,
a great game.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah, it was a really great Euro style game. So, glad to see that one is, it looks to be doing well. Now, let me ask you this. One of the reasons I like Origins is as an old time war gamer, I used to like to go to Origins because I knew GMT would be there, and occasionally MMP would have a booth. I know Callie from Strategy and Tactics.
All of them
games.
Were there. Lock and Load Games was there. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the name of the Russian companies, Atroba, something like that, were there. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people you would expect to have seen there in the old days, so to speak. GHQ was actually even there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, GHQ hasn't been to a show like this, I think he said, in 20 years.
So, for those of you who don't know, GHQ's claim to fame used to be Micro Armor. The strongest part of their whole line.
It is actually now again. Yeah. It is their bread and butter again. And they do point out that they're the oldest company in the industry. They've been around since 1967.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of staggering to hear that one. But, somebody who's been there longer than I have.
Well, I hope they come back. I truly do. I think, you know, there's something to be said for old school miniatures. I mean, I'm not going to go off on a huge tangent about it, but in the breadth of the hobby, right? The hobby is not just Euros. It's not just role playing. It's not just fantasy miniatures. There's this stuff that, you know, the game industry is as a whole has all these great sub niches that, you know, if you get exposed to them, it might light a fire.
Yeah, actually, one of the ones I thought was really neat, you know, there's always these sub genre ones, like people who sell swords, people who sell costumes, things like that. There was a store there, and I wish I could remember their name. There was a store there that was selling the minifigs from all the different Lego sets that was doing gangbuster business.
Oh. What, they broke them out of the Lego set and were selling them?
Yeah, they were all just the minifigs themselves. You didn't have to buy the sets. It was all just the minifigs. And they varied in price. You know, some were like $5, some were like $15, depended on what it was and the rarity of it. But yeah, it was really cool. You know, a bunch of the guys that I know go goobed up on all the superheroes. So they got a whole set of superheroes and things like that that Lego's
doing. Yeah, that's the kind of fun stuff that you find at a con that you're just not going to find anywhere else. So,
well, and there's games being played with it. And that, what I thought was really impressive, is it gave the opportunities for people who wanted to play their Lego games, the ability to buy into something. We don't see that at shows very often. When Lego's there, you know, they're not there like the,
you know, you can ask Dave Miller of the Purple Pawn and I how it is with Lego at a show, because we always go to the New York Toy Fair. And basically, unless you're one of the 12 apostles, you know, you just don't get to talk with Lego.
I thought they only let 11 of them, of those 12 in.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's you have to be a big retailer or one of the apostles to get in their booth. But anyways, I don't want to go too much on.
Yeah, I was just going to sum up one real quick thing. Well, first of all, the game attendance was tremendous. You know, excellent. Everybody was very pleased with all the game attendance, and it is a game show. From rumor, though no specifics from anyone I actually got confirmation from, rumor has it that they hit at least the same numbers as last year, which is good given the fact that they pushed it ahead so far. They were really concerned over what their attendance would be like.
Well, I was really concerned over what it would be like. I still think it's too early. Kids don't get out of school here until, you know, after that, and a lot of kids didn't get out until the middle of June. Now, granted, it's not necessarily the kid, it's not a kid show, so to speak.
No, but it does affect anybody who wants to go that has kids.
Yes, and if you're a college student who, let's face it, these are often the kind of people who attend cons, quarter system colleges don't necessarily get out of college until the middle of June.
Yeah, I believe they are moving the show 2 weeks later, so now it'll be like June 14th approximately.
I think that is the perfect time for it.
I do too. I think that was a really good slot for them. Anyway.
All right, so the other question I wanted to have, or the other mention that I wanted to make, not so much a question. One of the things that that Origins did a few years ago was go to the Exhibit Hall Only badge with a reduced price on, I think they started out on Sunday. It was like family day. It was $5 to get to the exhibit hall. And it really, their attendance numbers really ballooned. And it sounds like they've expanded that to Saturday. and those days are also doing really well. And I think that this is an excellent move for Origins.
I think it's
done gangbusters for them in terms of people who are just want to come in and check out the hall, or, you know, maybe who have kids, don't have time to sit down and play miniatures for 3 hours.
Right. I definitely think it's a boon to them. We had the discussion about this with Gen Con, and, you know, Gen Con's
right. Like Elizabeth,
said, they're an experience. Yeah. That's their target. They're an experience the whole 4 days.
Well, Elizabeth said too that a ton of people who buy 4 day badges don't also necessarily buy game tickets.
Right.
And that's a big revenue center for Gen Con, and they don't necessarily want to kill that golden goose just to pump some numbers.
Exactly.
Okay. That was Origins, our first news story. Great. We're like 20 minutes into the show. it's not only about 10 or 11 minutes, but all right. In other minor news, board game record shattered with a 61-hour, 22-minute session of Strat-O-Matic baseball. Can you believe that? Two guys from Minnesota sat down and played Strat-O-Matic for 61 hours and 22 minutes. The old record, I think, was a hair over 50 hours. And they blew away 111 games of Strat-O-Matic in 61 hours.
That's pretty impressive.
Now, they must not have been playing the rules light version of Strat-O-Matic. But I wanted to bring this out for a couple of reasons. This got some nice play, and in particular got some nice play for Strat-O-Matic, which has been around forever. You talk about the long tail, of commerce. They don't sell a ton, but they have such dedicated fans. Our good friend Dan Glovier, him and his friends still do Strat-O-Matic hockey every year. And it's one of those games that it's been around forever. You might not have heard of it, but these guys shattered the board game record with it. I don't know how they did 61 hours straight. I just absolutely cannot conceive of it.
You know, depending on their age, I'm considering either coffee or Mountain Dew was prevalent.
Judging from the pictures, I'm going to guess age was between 25 and 35.
So I'm thinking Mountain Dew was probably at the high end of this one.
Yeah, or maybe speed, just straight up.
I'm not going there.
So, yeah, after a while, they were making really bad managerial decisions. They looked like the Cubs.
I was going to say the Cubs, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, wave them home. Go ahead. Yeah.
Sure, what the heck?
Anyways, in some other minor news, Battleship bombed in the U.S. despite doing gangbuster business overseas. Taylor Kitsch, now box office poison. There was a lot of commentary. You know what's funny is there were actually some people who said, hey, this is a good movie. It's got lots of explosions, but there really is a human element. All I know is that the Taylor Kitsch's character's older brother was named Stone Hopper.
All right.
At which point I quit reading the review. But anyways, Battleship did not do well. I understand that Hasbro is doubling down. They're going to make a Tonka movie. But I think that...
Cars did well.
And
let's
honestly,
do Tonka.
Yeah, I think the Tonka, I think it is going to be an animated feature. Suffice to say that I don't think we're going to see a Catan movie anytime soon.
I'm not holding my breath on the Catan, the movie.
Yeah. Again, we've been talking about this meme for a while and what it means for marketing. But here's the big story, by the way, in game and product news. G.I. Joe has been pushed back, not just a little bit. G.I. Joe was pushed back from a June release to next March, theoretically so they could add 3D effects or make better 3D effects or something like that. Realistically, nobody pushes a movie like that back a year if it's not troubled.
Yeah, they've done something crazy with it.
Well, one of the speculations was they wanted to give, quote, a popular star more screen time, end quote, which to me means Bruce Willis gets his cameo extended. But that's a long time to push a movie back.
That's a huge time. That's a lot of money that's, you know, because they already were running, you know, advertising for it.
Correct. I mean, I already saw a trailer. So
right.
At which point it's really surprising. But here's the thing for our industry. Retailers and manufacturers are now on the hook for toy tie-ins.
Yeah. Right?
This stuff has been in channel for a year, and it was designed to hit I'm sure it's already on the shelf somewhere.
Either that or it's just starting to hit shelves.
Yeah. Now, we saw this, we talked about this, it was probably a couple years ago now, where they pushed back the Harry Potter film from a November release to a summer release, and I can't remember which one it was, but they pushed it back from November to summer. And in the process, bankrupted a games manufacturer in the UK who was going to make a Harry Potter board game.
Yeah, I remember the story, and yeah, it was pretty strange.
Yeah, it was, and again, this is what happens in the big money side of the industry is that this stuff starts in motion a year in advance, and you pony up a lot. I mean, the Harry Potter license, the G.I. Joe license, there's a lot of money at stake on these, and that money is generally up front plus a percentage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you were doing, for example, The Hobbit's coming out this December, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm sure there's a couple of companies that have already got tie-ins to the, you know, to do Hobbit products.
Yeah, well, now here's the thing with The Hobbit, G.I. Joe, and as has been mentioned online, The Avengers. A lot of the companies, a lot of the retailers, excuse me, didn't necessarily load up on Avengers movie merchandise. They moved all their old Iron Man crap.
Right.
Or Captain America or Thor. Right. Since there's already three movies.
They took the product they already had and, you know, put it up on
display. Sure. Took the discount sticker off of it and put it back out at full price. But anyways, so the interesting, again, it'd be interesting to see if that impacts at all and really the only way we'll know is if it shows up in a Toys R Us quarterly report,
right.
Which we can get online. And in other minor news, Strategy and Tactics is now on Facebook. Hello, Callie Cummins and others. I just wanted to mention this just because even the oldest of the old school are now embracing social media.
Yeah. Well, you know, lots of stuff going on in social media to make it very positive as a marketplace.
It's where you got to be.
Yes.
And finally, we talked before about the relationship, the sharing of information, the buy-in, you get people excited early. We won't go to that here, but again, Strategy and Tactics now on Facebook, I thought worthy of note. And I wanted to mention, there was a post, I found this on the Purple Pawn, and thank you. I think Dave Miller was the guy who posted it. It might have been Sam Mercer, but it was Ed Pugh of Reaper Minis doing a piece on YouTube. It's called, I want to give you the full title so that you can go to YouTube immediately after our show and listen to this. It's called The State of the Industry, Ed Pugh, P-U-G-H, parentheses, Reaper Miniatures, end parentheses. All right. The State of the Industry, Ed Pugh, Reaper Miniatures. Go and watch this. Ed talks about the change in distribution over the last few years, and it's nothing short of awesome, right? It's 7 minutes of really cool, you know, description of how the retailer, how the manufacturer and distributor relationship has changed. And in particular, I think he focuses a lot on, I'll give you in a nutshell. He talks about how basically the distributors no longer carry everything. Okay. And they don't push aggressively like they used to. And they pushed this back onto the manufacturers, and Ed talks about that change of dynamics and the impact it's had. Absolutely great stuff. Again, 7 minutes, 14 seconds worth of awesome sauce. You need to go listen to it or watch it. It's video.
Yeah.
So, and Red and I have very strong opinions about how distribution has changed, but I'm not entirely certain if we should go into them.
Not on tonight's show. Perhaps we'll do that in a future show.
Perhaps after a few beers. Catch us at Gen Con in the Hyatt Lounge. Yes, we will regale you for hours with what we really think. Anyways, definitely worth watching because distribution and manufacturing really has changed. And it was Ed's take on it was great. So definitely go give it a watch, a listen, whatever. He's got other stuff posted on YouTube. I haven't had a chance to watch those yet. But this one, definitely, if you're interested in the business side of the game industry, which should be you listening to the podcast, it's worth a watch. So, and speaking of the business side of the industry, Rhett, tomorrow is free RPG day.
Yes, it is. Yes. Another fine year of free RPG day.
I've been looking forward to getting my free rocket propelled grenade launcher.
I couldn't tell you quite how many because I wasn't given a complete list. I know five of them.
Here, start over again because I was talking over you in the expectation that you would stop so I could tell my not so funny joke. So free RPG day. What are some of the giveaways that you know about for free RPG day?
Well, there's a few out there. I know that we're seeing stuff from Wizards for 4th edition. They have a, I think it's a module for them. I know that Paizo has one for Pathfinder, another short module for those. I know there's an intro set for Catalyst Games for Battletech and Shadowrun, and a separate one for Cosmic Patrol. I've heard there's some dice out there again this year, a couple other odds and ends. I know there's other participants. I believe Green Ronin is participating again, probably their new RPG. Mm-hmm. But I don't have details on any of the others.
Okay. Any of it, is any of it good?
From what I've seen, everything is top quality. You know, it's all color, very slick covers. You know, most of them are like 20, 24, 48 page type of pieces out there. So, yeah.
So this is nice stuff. Okay.
This is really nice stuff. This is like...
this isn't like a mimeographed with a staple in the corner.
No, this is pretty much like the best way I can give an example that most people have seen is if you look at the very low end modules that Paizo produces for Pathfinder, it's a product like that.
Okay. So nice stuff. So again, this is a great idea for a medium to large size game company. The problem is that if you're a small game company, to print a 10-page module might cost you enough that it might really crimp you. And you're going to get lost in, oh, Paizo's got this, and they've got this, and they've got this. Might not necessarily be good if you're a small company. But for a medium-sized company, I think this is a great way to pimp your game.
I think it's a great way to pimp your game, but I think that's only half a step. You know, my opinion is still that if you really want to do it right, once you know the retailers that have it, you go out there and, you know, get your grassroots people to run it for them.
Yeah, this is exactly.
Just leave it lie. You don't let the product do it, do all the heavy lifting. You get out there and you get your people to run the events, show the people the flag, because it's still a limited quantity. And depending on the store, those could go pretty quickly.
Well, the other thing, too, is that the timing of Free RPG Day, someone actually put some thought into this. Thank God someone in the industry was thinking it's at the beginning of the summer selling season.
Yes.
Well, not necessarily the beginning, but really close to the beginning.
Close enough.
Yeah. And not like, say, Gen Con, which takes place late in August, right before everyone goes back to college.
Exactly.
Or work, as the case may be. But that said, Free RPG Day, we say it's tomorrow. By the time you get this show, it will be either today or yesterday. Sorry about that, gang.
That would be June 16th.
Yes, exactly. But anyways, that's all the news that is fit to print.
Even though we're not in print.
Yeah, actually.
They're just listening.
It was a figure of speech.
They're not watching us either.
Should I refer to them as our readers again?
You could always refer to them as our readers.
It took me a year to drop that habit.
I believe you still use it.
Thank you. I'm going to edit you out. All right, that said, let's move into our commentary. And I have been threatening to talk all about boxes for some time now. And some poor schmo actually said he wanted to hear about the All About Boxes episode. So because of that schmo, you guys are going to have to suffer through All About Boxes. Oh, Brett, by your silence, I'm assuming you're agreeing with them. But okay.
Boxes. Yeah. Boxes are really important, folks. This is what your product looks like.
Yes. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the technical stuff about boxes. And I'm not going to go into tons and tons and tons of detail about, eighths of an inch and things like that. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the technical stuff about boxes. And Red is going to interject marketing stuff. Yeah. Well, you're a marketing genius.
That would be it.
Well, yes. You're a marketing guy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I prefer genius, but I'll accept guy.
No problem. All right. So first, let's talk about tuck boxes. Tuck boxes are the small boxes. Usually, like if you buy a deck of, say, poker cards, usually they come in a tuck box. And now, tuck boxes have the virtue of being fairly cheap to make. Okay. You can get them glued on the bottom, which is, by the way, recommended for any tuck box where you're going to have – well, you're going to have, say, 100, 110 cards in it. The other option is like a double folding tuck box. Okay, both ends fold. Now, you're only going to use these for card games. Do not ever try and put anything gigantic in here. Do not also try and shoehorn lots and lots of stuff into a tuck box. The beauty of a tuck box is that if your manufacturer, I guess I mean printer, if your printer has a machine, you can have the machine. The machine will pack the tuck box and shrink wrap it. It drives your cost way down because there's no hand assembly. Yeah. Even with hand assembly, the savings on a tuck box is generally substantial over a setup box. But, and Rhett will talk about perceived value in a minute, it does diminish what you can sell it for. So anyways, tuck box is normally going to be, by the way, usually about 12 to 14 point thickness of material. Usually it's going to be a coated one side, plain, like solid white. It's not going to be chipboard or anything like that. And any thicker than that, and you're wasting money, and any thinner than that, it's just going to tear up when you try and put the cards back in it. So usually 12 to 14 point US measurements. If you want metric measurements, I apologize. There is no direct translation between grams per square meter and point size. Point size is a thickness measurement, and one is the other is a measure of density. So anyways, so 12 to 14 point thickness on your tuck boxes, only use them for card games. And Rhett, why should they only use them for card games?
For two reasons. Number one is it's the structure of the box. The cards basically are what's holding the box together. Without that content, with any loose content, it would just shatter. There's just not enough mass to it.
Yeah, you might be able to put I've seen people put a die in there and a timer. And like you can sometimes fit like a rule book behind two 55 card decks side by side.
Yeah.
But you're not going to put...
It also really requires filling the space, because if you don't, it's just going to crush. And that's a problem. The other is perceived value. It's small, it's light. People don't look at a product like that and expect to pay a lot of money for it. So if you're looking at a price point of over like $14.95 approximately, call it $15 retail, find a different product find a different way to display it, because people are looking for that to be inexpensive.
Yeah. Well, now, what do the Game of Thrones boosters go for? I think those are
$14.95.
Yeah. See there.
Those are like the high end of it. And, you know, you end up getting games that, the Looney Labs games, mm-hmm. All the various Looney Lab games that they have out there are in that kind of packaging. Flux is a good example of those. You know, like $12. You know, for the most part, I think they did a $20 one, but then again, they have a huge market based on their
correct,
their title.
So, all right. So tuck boxes, again, I've had people ask about doing board games in a tuck box, and it doesn't work. They're not sturdy enough. With board games and honestly with card games, the next big box is generally referred to as a setup box. There's a couple of different descriptions. I'm gonna try it because people use different names for these. When I say setup box, what I'm talking about is a chipboard, a piece of, you know, basically plain gray chipboard with a wrapper on it, right? With the graphics. Usually it's about 40 point, which is about half the thickness of a game board. Although any more out of China and occasionally out of Europe, where they also buy their paper in China, you're seeing the thicker boxes, the 60 and 80 point boxes, the really heavy ones. But 40 point is the standard, by which if you're printing your first game, trust me, go with a 40 point box. So a setup box is the standard box. Generally it's a full telescope box. By full telescope, we mean that the sides of the top come all the way down to the bottom. You will occasionally see gift style games like, you know, My Bridal Party or Girls Night Out kind of a thing have a half telescope box that makes it look more gifty. But you're probably going to be getting a full telescope setup box. They're really common. They're fairly cheap to make. They're a pain to ship. Okay, if you find a guy in Kentucky who makes really cheap paper boxes, you might want to look for somebody close by him in Kentucky to assemble your game. They take up a ton of space on a truck. But that said, there are some limitations on these type of boxes. One, depth will almost never, ever, ever be more than 4.5 inches, might be 4 inches, is the absolute deepest you're going to make a box. Do not plan your game around a 6-inch deep box. it will be bad. The other one is that most of these boxes, the biggest game I've ever seen was the Chaosal box, which was probably 2 feet on a side.
Yeah.
Most of the boxes, most of the guys are going to tell you 12 to 14 inches by roughly 24 inches is going to be as long as it can be, or as big as it can be. But definitely usually 4 inches or so, is about the depth on that. And honestly, the box is a cost. All right. Rhett's going to tell you it's presentation and stuff like that, but the box is a cost. The bigger your box, the more it costs.
That's right.
And so if you have extra space in your box, you could possibly have saved yourself a chunk of change. Because they use pre-printed or pre-cut squares, all right, to shape the boxes out of. So if they have to go up a size to a bigger square of chipboard, you have to pay for that even if you're not using the whole thing.
Right. Boxes are like one of the big things that people don't understand of the cost of manufacturing. There's an amazingly inexpensive level of goods inside of a box. You'd be surprised at how much the guts of a product may cost less than the package.
Yeah, quite possibly. Give you an example. When I was quoting 1,000-piece board games, a thousand run, several years ago, you would look at a board game, say a standard 20x20 quad fold board. That board might cost anywhere from, I don't know, $3 to $4. There's a couple of factors in there. And again, this is a short run. Is when you bump that up to say $2,500 or $5,000, the price drops dramatically. But on 1,000 pieces, roughly $3 to $4. The box, right, which doesn't impact the play of the game at all, would be somewhere between $2.50 and $3.
Yeah.
And that's a huge, and multiply that by four to figure out the impact at retail.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to think about, and it's one of the reasons why everyone went to the quad fold boards, because you could get a whole bunch more board into a much smaller box. Which leads me to the Monopoly style box. Don't do it ever. Just don't. It's a disaster.
Unless you really, really have to.
Unless your game says Monopoly or Opoly on it somewhere, do not do a 1.25 inch thick by 12 by 19 inch or whatever box that thing is. It's a disaster. It flexes a lot. It's hard to ship. It's hard to display. It's a mess. Retailers hate it. Consumers hate it, especially gamers, because all their games, you know, it doesn't fit with their other games on their shelves anymore. And it's expensive. It's really expensive. With a normal, with a 10 by 10 box, right? Or a 10.25 by 10.25 roughly. You can fit, it's not that you can fit the top and the bottom on the same sheet, but you waste a lot less paper, is what it comes down to. With the Monopoly box is a classic case. If you go to a much bigger sheet of chip, and it gets a ton more expensive. So never, ever, ever print a Monopoly style box. Period. Ever.
I think you've covered all the reasons why. Unless you're Hasbro.
That's what, you know, and that's the thing too.
And then why are you listening to our show to figure out how to make boxes? Yeah, and,
here's the caveat. Okay, if you're printing with, was it Late for the Sky, who basically does Opoly type games?
Right.
They have one size box, and it's a Monopoly style box, and you can get there. They'll give you a screaming deal on it, because that's all they do, and they print a zillion of them. So in that case, great. But if you're not printing a My Town Opoly or Horseopoly or whatever, don't go with that style box. Okay, I have to take a long breath. Okay, other types of boxes. Okay, wanted to talk very briefly. You'll see this games. I think Games Workshop uses this style box, and Multiman Publishing uses the gamers used to do it. It's printed on a thinner chip. It's a 24-point chip usually, but it's white. It's white paper. Okay, so it's actually it's not. I guess it's not really a chipboard, but it's a 24-point sheet of paper. So it's about half the thickness of a normal box, but you can print directly on it. You don't need a wrap. And so what they do is they stamp out the shape of the box. And then if you're lucky, your printer has a machine which automatically folds that box. So the sides of the box double up and give it a good rigidity. But you save a few steps in the manufacturing process, and it can come out cheaper. The problem comes is if you have to pay someone to assemble that box. Some of them will just snap together. Some of them will glue together when you fold them all back into shape. But if you have to pay for the labor, a lot of times it will come out actually close to the cost of a regular setup box. I saw this a lot when I was at Imagic Graphics, where we would quote these for people because we had all these great equipment to do it. And then by the time we factored in the labor to make the boxes, it wasn't worth it for them to do it. But now the advantages to it, like I said, if somebody does it, it's cheap. Usually, I think the colors pop a little bit the box is lighter generally, and so it's going to be an easier ship. And the gamers, by the way, was doing this for years and years and years before they got bought by Kurt Schilling's Multiman Publishing. And what they would do, which I have to say, by the way, total genius, they would basically have the Chicago area war gamers truck on down to Homer, Illinois, get free labor for a day. All those guys would assemble boxes and then, you know, and then fill the games and go home with a free game. But they didn't have to pay the cost of getting the boxes assembled. So absolutely brilliant if you have access to that kind of free labor.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the other style of box. And then where are we going to go with this? Set up boxes in terms of card games. All right. We talked about perceived value a little bit. If you go with a setup box that is, say, a couple of decks of cards, maybe there's going to be a little divider in the center with a rule book over the top. I'm thinking here about some of the stuff that Fantasy Flight Games has re-released. Mm-hmm.
Magic does this kind of a package.
Exactly. In the packaging, all right, now we were saying $15 for a tuck box. This stuff is retailing for $20 to $30.
Right.
So all of a sudden you've jumped in price point, perceived value by the customer. Good to know, because I mean that box is going to cost you a little bit more, but it's not going to cost you $10 more, and it might not cost you $2 more. So you can make more money doing this if your game is the right type of game. If it's a game that's going to that's going to sell in the hobby market, people don't mind spending $20 to $30 for. All right,
Expansions. There's a lot of expansions. You may have a standard board game. Let's use like Dominion as an example. They have a card game in a board game size. You have an expansion coming out. You don't need that big package anymore. You just need those expansion cards. This is a way to set it. And you can get into that value because your primary game is what's selling it, and these are the add-ons.
Correct. And certainly for the add-ons, people don't necessarily want to pay the same price for the full game as they do for the add-ons. Dominion, of course, being the huge exception to this.
Even the new Dominions actually got small ones now at this pricing.
I haven't even been out to see the latest one yet. So
okay. It's like $18.
Yeah. The thing too that about that is there's the other extreme, and the game I'm thinking of here is, okay, I'm going a ways back here. Remember Avalon Hills Guerrilla?
Sure.
Okay. Guerrilla was a card game. I think there was 110 cards and an 8.5 by 11 rule book in the standard 9 by 12 Avalon Hill 2-inch box.
Right.
And there were two dice. This was gross over packaging for this game. It should not have been in a box that big.
Right? Yeah, it simply fit into their regular footprint, which is, I think, where they were headed.
Yeah, and I know that's exactly why they did it. I'm sure they got a great deal on the boxes from a perspective of a company that's not Avalon Hill. It made it feel really light.
Yeah, it goes back again to that perceived value by consumers. I'm astonished by the heft test, you know, that still goes on.
Oh,
you know, people look at a price, they lift up the game, and they go, "Yeah, that's worth it." They would be happy.
I do it myself if I haven't reviewed the game on Board Game Geek, and I, you know, the internet connection's slow at the store. I'll go, "This one weighs more." Okay, you know, and it's sometimes it's subconscious, but customers do take that into account. So absolutely. Again, you don't want to, like I said, again, you don't want to have too much air in the box. The other reason too, by the way, if you have a lot of cards. And things like that, they can shift in transit. Pallet drivers will hate your guts if you have a lot of stuff moving around in your box. By the way, you'll hate that as well when they fall off of the pallet and you don't have them.
Or worse conditions, you know. Yeah,
exactly.
The damages and everything else you're absorbing.
Yeah, you might have to eat that yourself. So again, be careful on that. We could do a whole show about box dividers. Let's not.
Why do you need these?
Yeah. I used to have to make that. I used to have to make that sell all the time when I was selling printing. Is people would say, "Well, why don't we just take that? Why don't we just take that divider out? Why do we even have to have that in the box?" And the reason was because all of your stuff shifts to the left, and you got 400 games on a pallet, or it's going to fall off the pallet and get damaged. So, other things, shrink wrap, yes. You are going to do shrink wrap, and you're going to be happy about it. The only exception to this might be if you do tuck boxes, in which case you can get away with the little clear security tape. But you know,
I don't see very much of that even. Most things are shrink wrap. Not everything, but yeah, most things, no matter what size they are, they're shrink wrap. And in part, that's to protect the retailer, because that makes taking any component out very difficult.
Well, you know, the other reason for this too, and this is a technical manufacturing thing, I worked at a printer that printed tons and tons and tons of flashcards. And they were packaged in tuck boxes, and they were cards in a box. They weren't a game, but they were, you know, flashcards. And they weren't shrink-wrapped because it was for the educational market. It was a little different. But so we'd stack these things in boxes. We'd put them on the pallets. We'd load them on a truck. The truck would rock back and forth for 3 days out to wherever it was going. And they'd get there, and there'd be rub damage.
Yeah.
Because these things it was a little freaky. There had been a weird weather front, so they'd been packaged where it was warm and humid. They went through a cold freezing front, something like that and stuff. But what it came out was the stuff was damaged. And that was basically a half a semi full of cards that we had to eat and remanufacture. Because at that point it was considered a manufacturing defect, not a shipping problem. So again, there's a reason to do shrink wrap other than store security and customer tampering. But yes, definitely do shrink wrap. Do not complain about the nickel and a half that it adds to your price. The other thing I used to get questions on all the time is, do we really need to do these in shippers? Can you just pack them, you know, just out of stack all the games on a pallet and we'll deal with the shipping. This appeals to people who are buying 1,000 to 2,500 games, and they're going to be shipping them out of their garage. The problem is that it's grossly unprofessional. Your games are much more likely to get damaged. It's pack your games 6 to a shipper, 12 if they're a card game, and be happy about it. Usually it adds, I want to say you can get a good shipping bot carton for anywhere from $1.50 to $2, and you amortize that cost. That'd be on the high range. But you amortize the cost of the shipper over however many games you can fit in it. But your shipper is your case pack. So put some thought into it. Because you're going to tell retailers, well, you got to order in breaks of 6, or you got to order in breaks of 4, or in terms of card games, you know, 12 or whatever. So put some thought into the shippers. And finally, Rhett, I have to close with clamshells.
Yeah.
Don't do a plastic clamshell. Ever. If you are tempted to do this, don't. The only ones I've seen do it recently were Mayfair with the little, Le Boom?
Yes.
Game, which was a great game. It was designed to retail at about $3 or something like that, or really cheap, $4. And it worked because there's two parts to the game, and they printed the rules on the insert into the clamshell. The last company I saw to go big on clamshells with games was a company out of Canada. Specialty board games. SBG did tons and tons and tons of business with Walmart. And I can tell this story about SBG games because they're now bankrupt. but SBG was doing a ton of business with Walmart. They were doing a ton of licensed board games and other stuff through Walmart. And Walmart said, you know, this would be really cool if we could do these in clamshells. We would love to sell your games in clamshells. So they produce the games in clamshells. Walmart tests them and finds out customers didn't want a board game because what happens was, okay, let's take an example. NASCAR trivia game with a DVD. You downsize the board, you print it on 24 point that folds up in there. So, and it fit, you put a DVD in the clamshell and all of a sudden you have reduced the value of this product from $19.95 to $10. It was a huge drop in perceived value. Meanwhile, they had spent $50,000 in clamshell packaging, molding, and engineering. And they had, I think they'd launched 5 games in the clamshell packaging, and it was an utter disaster. Because customers didn't want it, and the perceived value dropped so low that they couldn't move the product. So, clamshells, no. Unless you're doing miniatures, right?
I was going to say, the only miniatures definitely has some advantages to clamshells because you can then view the product.
Well, here's a good question.
But on a board game end, no, they really...
Yeah, or even a card game. Even a card game. Don't do a card game in a blister pack.
Yeah.
But here's the question I want to ask for you in terms of miniatures. Blister pack with the paper backing or clamshell blister pack with a paper insert?
They had their advantages in both
cases. As a miniatures guy, yeah.
Most of the companies that use a clamshell are doing it because they have a card that they need to fit in with the product, mm-hmm. and they want to make sure that that card is secure and safe and doesn't get glued. Where if you've got just standard miniatures, so like Iron Wind, Battlefront, GW, they're just using the standard backed cards.
Yeah, it's...
Reaper, yeah. You know, Reaper uses that very small shell, vacuum shell for like a single figure. So those are even, you know, less expensive to manufacture because they're not using anywhere near the same amount of plastics.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those issues of scale too, right? Since you have to pay for an expensive mold usually to, unless somebody has an existing mold that you can pay a small fee to use. But for things like miniatures or card games, God forbid, you're going to do that. It's going to be more difficult to find something. You'll have to pay custom. So anyways, so that was all about boxes. Now I can go on and on and on about printing. I'm not going to tell you about optimal sizes. In terms of, there are breaks in terms of the printing. Usually you don't save enough. Like, for instance, if you go from a 10.5-inch box to a 9-inch box, you can print the top and the bottom together. Honestly, usually the savings aren't enough to necessarily justify it, so just go with whatever gets the biggest board for you. That'll sell your game more than anything else. But anyways, that was all about boxes. Now, I'm sure we'll have tons and tons of questions because people are fascinated about boxes. Yes. Oh, and don't do a box like Castle. We loved the game dearly. We love the designer. He's a great guy. But Castle was too big. Who was it who did the Octagon box? Wasn't that one of the trivia games?
There's a couple of them. I can't think of it. It was it used balls like a checker style game.
I can't
remember the name.
There
of
was
it.
A baller, Balboa, yeah.
Balboa or something like that. And again, it used a hexagon or an octagon shape for it. They don't fit on the shelves. They don't look right on the shelf.
Yeah, and if you're stacked edge
retailers
on.
Retailers don't like them, and retailers not liking your product is bad because they are the first line of sale.
Yeah, and again, if it's a hexagon, okay, then you're not going to get the full sides, right? You're going to get a playing card size piece of the box, assuming it's a standard square box that's going to be able to sell the game on the shelf. So, stick with boring, stick with square, stick with rectangular. By the way, if you go with rectangular, don't do one of those clever boxes that's like 10.25 by 10.5 that you look square but isn't. As a consumer, I hate these. This is just a personal pet peeve. Now we're not.
Sadly, I agree with you, but make yeah.
It, yeah, put another really inch on it so that I know it's rectangular. All right. Anyways, let's move on. We got we have a listener mail from Mr. Alex Swingle. He wanted to weigh in on the pseudo controversy that was computer games board game design, and he disagrees with me, which is completely fine. So this is Alex. He says, I have a counterpoint to why the statement of board game to computer game isn't completely true. He says, I'll use an analogy that should give some clarity as to what I mean exactly. So clarity and exactly in the same sentence. Listen up. You have to learn how to water paint before painting the Mona Lisa. Computer games are in the same realm of board game in the sense they have structure, mechanics, and hopefully isn't confusing for the user. Ultimately, though, they are different platforms and have to be approached differently because of the tools required to make them. There are simply some things that can't be done well for a board game that computers do, and vice versa. Bean counting is the easiest example of bad game design for board games. It's a huge waste of time and doesn't enhance gameplay. So he goes, sorry it took so long. I thought you guys were done with that statement and waiting to say my piece on the matter. So, Alex, thank you for weighing in on that. So if you have a thought on the ongoing controversy, or non-controversy as it has turned out to be, of do you need to design a board game before you can design a computer game, how can you contact us? Rhett, tell them.
Well, you could reach us on the website at purplepawn.com/papermoney. You could email us at papermoney@purplepawn.com. You can Skype us on Paper Money Podcast.
Bless you.
Or
you can just check out our RSS feed at purplepawn.com/category/papermoney/feed and weigh in the show notes. So that said, Rhett, what's next?
What's next? Well, in 60 days, it will be Gen Con.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a long time, though. You know, from Origins to Gen Con, that's a long time.
I think my wallet just
groaned. Only 60 days till Gen Con.
Yes, 60 days till Gen Con. Summer buying season is in full swing. If you are planning on a Christmas or Thanksgiving release of your game and you have not yet started manufacturing,
get to it.
Yeah. In fact, if you're going overseas, I would say last week was too late, but you might make it.
Yeah, you're still safe. If you're pressing for the late November release, you probably can have it to them by the 1st of July.
Yes. If you don't have a quote yet, you're only going to be able to get it done domestically, and even then, So, yes. So, from that timeline, our next show is going to be, I believe, the first week of July, which being July 4th week is going to be a little dicey, as we've shown with our steadfast ability to maintain dates.
Ah, but fortunately, the 4th of July is on a Wednesday.
Yes. Which is traditionally we've recorded the show on a Monday, and I've edited on Tuesday or Wednesday, so we'll see how that works out for that week.
It's an exciting week, you know, because no one really knows what day to take off. You know,
yeah,
do they give you Tuesday off? Do they give you Thursday off? Do they just make you go to work all the time?
Yeah, well, that would be, you know, how I traditionally work, which is, you know,
all the time.
Yeah, I, you know, well, I'm chained to my oar, so. All right, that said, everyone, have an excellent, excellent summer. We will talk to you in just a few short weeks. I'm Ben Clark.
And I'm Red Kip.
Well, that went reasonably well.
Yeah, a little, you know, good bus.